Now, somebody wrote me a question and said, but isn't that part of practice to stay in the stickiness of blood relationships and try and work our way out of it? Well, you know, blood relationships are only sticky because our mind makes them sticky. Okay? Just because we're related by blood to somebody doesn't really mean much unless our mind makes it a big deal, if you get what I mean. Yeah. Because are you your body? Is that who you are? Are you your body, and so therefore the people who have the same genes as you do are therefore part of you, and you've got to have this stickiness and possession and obsession with them? I don't think so. You know, our body is just something we're born into this lifetime. You know, this body comes, this body goes. Yeah, we have certain blood relatives this life, but it's not the genes that make us connected. It's our mind that makes a big deal out of being blood relatives. Okay? And so it's the mind that makes the attachment, that makes the thing of, you know, this is so important. So I'm not saying that we shine on blood relatives and just forget you. I'm not saying that. But, you know, to recognize that this is not an inherently existent relationship, and that the my in it is something that's merely labeled by our conventions. My sister, my brother, my parent, my child, my spouse, whatever it is. Yeah? But this is the my got in there because we put it there. You know, we labeled it like that. And of course, anything that we give the label my to gets extra special attention because it's related to the center of the universe, me. Yeah? So that's why I said it's very helpful to take the my out of it, because it helps us put this in more more perspective and not be so upset. We might still see that what somebody is doing is harmful, but we don't have the same upset feeling about it and frustration because we can't make them be different. And that's important because the frustration and that wanting to control actually blocks our relationship with them. Whereas if we're a little bit more open because we've taken the my out of it, then when they decide they want to change, the door is open and we're ready to communicate. Okay? And this is one of the things that I work with prisoners, and what they all tell me is that you don't change until you really want to. And a lot of them have, the guys I write to have had drug and alcohol problems. They've gone to programs for drug and alcohol abuse. They complete the programs because they know how to fake it. You know, and because the courts told them they have to do it. But they have no intention at all of keeping clean. Yeah. But one guy wrote me, and he told me this, but he said, once I was in prison and I decided I wanted to get clean, then I didn't need a drug program to get me clean. I did it by myself because of the power of the determination. Yeah. So it's like that with a lot of the things. I think, we have to be there as a support, and it came up in a previous discussion we were having. Sometimes only when we're really at the bottom of the barrel do we decide that we have to change. And if that's true for us, then that's also true for family members, isn't it? And so sometimes we have to have the patience, as painful and excruciating as it is, to watch people make a mess before they can get it together and get better. Yeah. Now, like I said, that doesn't mean that we just lay back and, you know, fine, I don't care. We can try and intervene when we can, and especially if what a relative is doing is endangering somebody else. You know, like if a brother or a sister is doing something really nuts and their kids are suffering as a result, You know, we might have to intervene. Sometimes the way of intervention is just to tell the other person the effect their behavior is having on us. Because sometimes they don't want to hear advice. They've been hearing advice for years about what they should do. They don't want to hear any shoulds. But sometimes if we just say, you know, this is what you're doing and this is how it's affecting me, and you need to know that. Sometimes, you know, that might wake them up enough, okay, to want to start changing themselves. But sometimes it doesn't make them up enough. We don't know, do we? So it's hard. It's hard, you know. And I think this is where the meditations on love and compassion, joy and equanimity can be very, very helpful. Yeah. That when we have a basic attitude of love or friendliness towards somebody, when they experience happiness, we feel joy about it. When they experience suffering, we feel compassion, wishing them to be free of suffering. And when they get really stuck and we can't do anything to help them, we have to have a feeling of equanimity ourselves, of, you know, being able to go through this difficulty with them, with a sense of compassion that if we're hurting because a family member is doing this and that, imagine what's going on with them. Yeah? Have you ever thought about that? The person that you're really mad at, that you really wish would change, and you think, you're making me suffer so much because you're doing this, and then you start thinking of what it's like to be the other person, and then you really see, wow, that person's suffering more than I am. Yeah? Especially like when somebody just starts criticizing us, criticize, then, you know, we can feel really, really down, like, wow, all this person does is just criticize me. But then imagine being that person and having such a judgmental, critical mind, you know, and imagine them being so judgmental and critical of somebody who cares about them. That must be very, very painful for them to have that mental state and not be able to deal with it. So if we can see that, then we can have some compassion for them instead of getting angry back. It's hard, but it's possible. Mm-hmm.